The AMS Food Bank provides confidential and non-judgmental food options to members of the Queens community in the most comfortable environment possible. The Food Bank helps to ensure that Queens students can be healthy and productive as they pursue academic achievement and alleviates poverty amongst Queens community members. We are open Monday to Friday from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. in room 105 of the Rideau Building. For entry into the Food Bank, we ask to see the sticker on the back of your student card to ensure you are a valid student. We have an amazing team of volunteers to welcome you and answer any questions you may have. To donate, you can e-transfer controller at ams.queensu.ca with the subject line AMS Food Bank Donation, or bring non-perishables to our location during the service hours. Also, check out the Pay What You Can Peach Market, providing equal access changing hunger, in the new medical building for fresh soup and entrees on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. For any questions, please reach out to foodbank@ams.queensu.ca.
CNIB's Mobile Hub is coming to Kingston on August 7th from 10:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. at the Central Branch of the Kingston Public Library. The Canadian National Institute for the Blind is hitting the road to bring its innovative programs and technology to you. Drop in to meet CNIB staff and learn more about the free programs and resources for people who are blind, deafblind, or have low vision. Explore assistive tech with hands-on product demos and workshops.
So welcome everybody to our first external visitors talk of the year in our visiting speaker series. I'm going to just start off, of course, by acknowledging that Queens is situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and the Haudenosaunee. And we are in acknowledging this traditional territory. We are recognizing its long history, and especially its significance for the Indigenous people here who have lived and continue to live on it, and whose practices and spiritualities are closely tied to the land and that continue to develop today, along with other inhabitants in this area. And so we're very grateful to be able to live and especially to learn today on this territory together. So now let me pass on and introduce our guest for today. This is Professor Nate Algilbois, and I'm going to actually consult my paper because the list of accomplishments and things to read is always so long for people. Nate has a law degree from the University of Tel Aviv in Israel, as well as an LLM and a PhD. And I'm most familiar with Maytel's work in the area of law and economics, but she also has a lot of scholarship in the area of tort law theory, and private law remedies, which are areas where she also teaches currently at Bar Ilan University, where she is presently, and where she will be teaching when she joins the Faculty of Law at Western this coming January. She's a very accomplished scholar. I actually always love seeing her work. It's so interesting, and it actually spans quite a lot of different areas. So this is a paper that's going to speak to climate change. But I know for those of you who are interested in tort law remedies, law and economics, there are many other topics that you could look to Maytel's work to learn about. In addition to her degrees, she has received funding from the Israel Science Foundation, German-Israeli Foundation for Scientific Research and Development. There's a lot of accolades, right? Anyway, I just want to say I'm really, really delighted to be able to welcome you here today to speak to this topic in particular. It's a really novel paper about an interesting and important, obviously, global policy challenge. So just delighted to be able to welcome you here. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much. So first, thank you, Sherry, for organizing this, for initiating this lecture, and thank you for having me here. Also to the one who are listening through Zoom. I don't know, do you want me to just speak, right, for 40 minutes and then Q&A? Would you like to... Whoever has questions may feel comfortable to ask anyway. So indeed, this lecture is based on a paper that was really recently published, a week ago, I think. It went on print Law Journal, and this is the link for whoever will want to read the whole paper. And this will be sort of a brief, but also my take and my thoughts on different aspects. I will try to enhance some of them here. And this project relates to other line of projects that I'm dealing with, writing about, that are really on the scene between the public and the private. So this is, of course, perhaps climate change is the greatest challenge of our times, public global immense issue. And maybe while it is so immense and pose such challenges, it's yet seen that the law is dashing behind and not even slightly catching up with this enormous challenge that we are facing. So this project is not going to change all that, but it entails a really much more modest purpose, which is to provide an additional legal avenue to take us another step forward to contend with this immense challenge. And I think perhaps in a legal arena that actually can do that more effectively than what we probably think, because, and I will get to it, it's hardly being used or really considered in the context of climate litigation currently. So what this project is about really is a first step in the sense that it offers a framework, a theoretical and doctrinal framework based on this legal field that has hardly been used in this context, the law of unjust enrichment, that is. And we term this intersection between this idea of climate litigation and unjust enrichment, climate enrichment. Okay, now this intersection of a huge legal problem and private law field that is considered perhaps, as I told Sherry before, maybe the most controversial private law field is not obvious. And so I will want to convince you that it is necessary to be considered as a legal means to contend with this huge problem. Again, a first step in this direction. So to get to this point of explaining the advantages of this proposal, climate enrichment, and to show you how it can be doctrinally used, utilized in order to really become a useful means, I think we first have to really ask the question of the more natural front of this problem, which is public law, right? It is the most natural front to face such a monumental global, right, problem. We basically want to think that we need public law solutions, which should be developed through national law as well as public international law. But the problem is that regulation alone has proven to be insufficient for this task. And I will only mention a few reasons. I'm sure that you're familiar with most of them or even more of them, that I will mention a few. So, of course, efforts to address the climate crisis through legal means often face opposition from powerful commercial interest groups. Future generations are at disadvantage, of course, in the political side, right? Regulators respond to interests and problems that concern and affect their present voters. And of course, we have also behavioral problems. For instance, over-optimism or myopia, right? Individuals tend to systematically prefer short-term benefits and usually bias toward immediate rewards at the expense of long-term outcome. As for failures of the national regulation, such failures generally relate to the fact that climate change is fundamentally a global problem, and the global front opens the door to problems concerning the need to effective interstate coordination and enforcement, right? So we want to think that all the states are driven by this shared mission, but really each country has a strong incentive to continue polluting rather than adopt restricting environmental policies and regulations. And the reason for all this, the reason what underlies all these elements or causes is really that polluting is profitable. So perhaps it's naive to think that solutions can come from powerful commercial interest groups without tighter regulation enforcement, all the while that the countries themselves are struggling to give up competitive advantages and short-term benefits of environmentally harmful practices and policies. So against this background, private litigation can provide useful means to some extent, of course, to fill some of these gaps left by unsuccessful regulation. And indeed, private citizens have been attempting to battle the harmful effect of climate crisis through the court system by using private litigation. This type of litigation is typically focused on tort law, which is quite understandable, right? It's quite intuitive in this context. After all, we are facing with immense harm, losses, disasters, and tort law is the law of harm, is the law of loss, is what comes to mind when we think about disasters or harmful effects. But here again, we can think about the disadvantages of loss-based litigation, or what sometimes I term in my even other papers that does not really target only climate change issues, tort-style litigation. Okay. What this project, what we raised here, and was raised by others before, is that the features of climate harms consist of structural and conceptual problems, rendering tort law less compatible in the context of climate litigation. In particular, any one of the traditional elements of tort claim may prove problematic in this context. Now, I'm not going, of course, to start giving a tort class here, but I do want to mention the basic elements because each of them really entails some difficulties to contend with the problem at hand. Okay, we have particular really unique features of climate change effect. And I think that this is the core problem with how we face these issues with litigation thus far. We have to face this problem and acknowledge the fact that these elements are, in this sense, problematic. And now I will elaborate a bit. So first, duty and breach. A successful tort claim must demonstrate particular wrongful conduct or breach of duty. So examples are, of course, violation of regulation and gross negligence and nuisance and so forth. However, in some cases, and this is interesting, actually, I think that this is a real contribution of our paper, but the main contribution of our paper, at least, I will elaborate on this later on. In many cases, the detrimental effects of climate stability are caused by activities that are not necessarily rendered wrongful, not in the tortious sense. Okay. So to say that tort law can really contend or face these types of harmful effects is to miss it altogether. We are blind to these types of something that seems unjust. I'm already here stepping forward, but it's not really wrongful. We can't really think about it through the lens of tort law. What about harms? So tort law primary function is compensating, right, for harms. Every tort scholar, I think this is the first intuition, right, that we have. The function of restoration, right? Aiming to return the plaintiff to the position they were, but for the wrongful conduct. But in the context of climate change, main concern is one of future harm, right? Harm that have not yet occurred. They are in this sense plausible, perhaps very plausible, extremely plausible, but they can be very far away into the future, 50 years from now, 100 years from now. Okay. How can we speak in the language of restoration in this context? Right? There are also practical problems with harms. Right? Future harms are plausible, I said. They are very difficult to prove in this sense, right? They're difficult to measure accurately. And even if we can prove that heat wave will surely result in drought, tropical storm, and enhanced mortality rates, it seems almost impossible to put an exact dollar sum on such future harms. And as impossible to translate these abstract harms into compensatory damages. And what about causation? So, of course, to establish any tort claim, it's not enough to show that the defendant acted wrongfully and the harm. We also need to establish a causal link between that wrongful conduct and the harm that resulted. But again, causation, of course, as you probably all of us know, is one of the most complex elements in the law in general and in tort law in particular, right? So now imagine this complexity when it comes to the complex nature of climate change effects, future harms as well, right? Also, climate change is not a result of any single polluting activity, but rather a complex result of actions taken over years by multiple entities. And it's very difficult to identify the contribution of each specific emitter to a detrimental effect of global warming. Who is responsible to the global process melting of melting glaciers and resulting sea level rise? And to what extent? This is especially true when it comes to future harms, as I said, right? So with these difficulties in mind, the argument is not that tort law is relevant. There are particular features of tort law that are compatible. This is not what we do. But the idea is not to throw away tort law, but rather to consider very seriously a supplementary, likely more effective legal field that is unjust enrichment and the cause of action of climate enrichment that now I can finally turn to and explain more. But to explain this cause of action based on unjust enrichment, as I said, climate enrichment, that I do claim that it has advantages when it comes to the unique features of climate detrimental effect, I need first to address or especially address the main principle of unjust enrichment, and then I will be able to present each of the elements of the cause of action and explain to you why it is so advantageous comparing to cause of action that is usually being used in these types of litigation, which is tort law. But before moving to this, again, I want to show you the principle itself. Well, this is taken from the restatement, the American restatement. However, I have to say that it's really in different version, the common law idea of unjust enrichment, principle of unjust enrichment. So a person who is unjustly enriched at the expense of another is subject to liability and restitution. This is usually termed as a principle of unjust enrichment, the general principle. And as I said, this is probably the common law version of unjust enrichment in different, with minor changes here and there. So here I want to mention two main paradigms of unjust enrichment. And again, I'm not going to leap over the script to make it an over descriptive explanation in this sense, but I do need to take to really distinguish the two paradigms apart in order to then present to you the idea of each element and how it really can be of advantage for the purpose of climate enrichment cause of action. So there are two main paradigms, and the first category is one of wrongful enrichment. So that is wrongful conduct. So So in the context of climate litigation, what it means is that sometimes enrichment benefit to the defendant can derive from wrongful conduct, okay? And in the climate context, climate change context or climate litigation, we can say, for example, that when a profit derives from violation of regulation or gross negligence, it is deemed unjust, this type of profit. So in these cases, the restitutionary remedy is one of disgorgement. This is how this is the term for restitutionary remedies in cases where it derives from wrongful conduct. And the function of remedy in those cases is particularly known as one of stripping the wrongdoer from their ill-gotten gain. However, and this is interesting because here I think there is a lot of work to do, and I hope that we managed to do the first step in this paper. Enrichment can also be considered unjust when the defendant is not engaged in any wrongful activity. The core example of unjust enrichment in these cases is, of course, mistaken payment. So a recipient of a mistaken payment is liable for restitution even if the transfer of money was done without their fault, and even if the mistaken payer was negligent when they transferred this sum of money, right? Similarly, a patient can be considered unjustly enriched if they received life-saving treatment while being unconscious, right? They didn't ask for it, it wasn't intentional that they took the treatment, right? They didn't take anything. And they will still be required to pay for the treatment that they received with due care and skill.
Yeah.
I know. I've been told when I presented this in England.
Yeah.
Yes, I know.
Well, maybe just say we all pay.
Well, yeah, but I've been told it's an American approach. Let it be an American approach. Well, it was published in an American law review.
Yeah.
But I have to say, I have a lot to say about that, but we will, if you'll ask more about that, I'll be happy to. Yeah. Well, the reason that the defendant in these examples is considered unjustly enriched, and here again, it's on the surface. I'm not going to dive into theories here of why it is unjust in these cases. Of course, there are so many different views on this. Robert Stephen just published a book, and it's really, there's so much literature in this aspect, but let's, for the purpose of this lecture, say that they were not entitled, okay, to get this benefit. And in this particular sense, they got more than their fair share, okay? They weren't supposed to get this benefit. They got more than their fair share. I will return to this thought. But now that I introduced the principle and the two different paradigms for this principle, I want to zero in on the doctrine of unjust enrichment. And through introducing its basic element, to introduce the doctrinal advantages of climate enrichment as a cause of action in climate litigation. So these are, as the general principle just showed us, really three basic elements. So we have the enrichment, which is the benefit to the defendant. We have the unjust element. And we have the at the expense, the causal so-called element of this cause of action. And I will want to have some, I have something to say about each of these. So we will, and I think that this is exactly the work that's supposed to be done in order to convince that this doctrine is at least until the advantage that we should consider when we think about using it. So starting with the focus on the benefits, the first and maybe perhaps the distinctive, right, the distinctive element of this cause of action, the focus on the defendant benefit rather than on the plaintiff's loss. What we usually do in law, right? We usually focus on the loss, as I said, restorative function, right? We want to restore the plaintiff to the position that they were, but for the breach, but for the violation of the right. So through this element and its focus on the defendant's benefit, this cause of action addresses the main reason that underlies human-driven global warming, which is that polluting is profitable. So this is already a first advantage in the sense that this cause of action tackles, in this element, first element, the potential drive of these types of violations, right? Of environmental violations. Perhaps this could be viewed as a potential advantage as well. But what I want to mention is other advantages as well, okay, that are more perhaps intuitive. So first, the element of benefit entails several advantages, such as the fact that, as opposed to the harms that are, as I said, very abstract, may materialize only in the future, profits are here and now, and therefore easier to prove. While the harms are spread and may be borne by all, which is very problematic in tort law terms, as we know, the gains are rather concentrated. They are here and now, and quite a few firms, and here I will talk about this later on, I will talk about the unjust element, okay? But only a few firms in the energy sector making unimaginable profits can be potentially caught in this net. Okay. Now, the profit is quantifiable, measurable, and not really speculative, at least to some extent, of course, less than, again, the abstract nature of harm resulting from climate change. And even if measuring enrichment can involve some difficulties, of course it can, it's avoided daunting problems of translating abstract values to monetary terms. The second element, unjust, really the normative net, right? What do we capture? What enrichment can be really viewed as unjust? So this is really the big question, or at least one of them. So as I noted before, of course, that a profit resulting from wrongful conduct on behalf of the defendant, for example, as a result of a breach of regulation, can easily meet the unjust requirement. We understand why. It's unjust. It's illegal. It's violation of regulation. But the law of unjust enrichment allows restitution not only in cases in which gain derives from wrongs, as I said, it also allows restitution. And again, I know that this is the American version, but we can look at it as distinct paradigms for that, because they are distinct paradigms. When the defendant otherwise unjustly enriched, right, obtained benefit to which they were not entitled. And the proposed framework of climate enrichment offers theoretical reasoning for this notion of unjust enrichment. And the idea of unjust that we offer relies on the notion of climate stability, that climate stability is a global public good. And the thought is that resources such as breathable air, clean water, reasonable temperature, inhabitable environment that belong to all people, belong to us living here and future generation, are, in fact, this shared public good of climate stability. And what we are currently witnessing is unjust enrichment in possession of climate stability, which is defined in this project in terms of disproportionality. So the idea that the just state of affairs should be that we all pollute and thus take our fair share of climate stability and benefit from it to some extent. But some makes an oversized contribution to climate change through their activity, taking a grand share of our public property of climate stability. Their activity produces major benefits, and this benefit is disproportionately concentrated with them. So these are the three very generic requirements that we note. Of course, this can be developed and should be further refined and developed, right? Through the implementation of this very generic, you know, principle over also over litigating cases. But this idea of disproportionality is what we think makes or can make or meet the requirement of unjust in the cause of action of climate enrichment. So this should be true for a handful of energy sector firms for which the crisis generates unimaginable profits far beyond the general level of fair share in climate stability. Under the condition delineated in this scheme, consumers and small manufacturers will not be held liable in restitution for contribution to climate stability, for climate change, because they do not take more than their fair share in climate stability. Whoever takes much more than their fair share and immensely profits as a result can be perceived as unjustly enriched and be liable in restitution. Lastly, we come to the third, and again, you will see again, I will divide it into two different ideas in, according to the two main paradigms of unjust enrichment, the wrongful enrichment and unjust enrichment. We come to this last element of the general principle of unjust enrichment at the expense of another. So only a plaintiff at whose expense the defendant was unjustly enriched may have a valid claim in unjust enrichment. In this sense, the at the expense element concerns the idea of standing, right? Who can have a claim against a defendant polluter in unjust enrichment? So as for unjust enrichment or climate enrichment, not a wrongful one, even if each individual plaintiff can only sue for a relatively small sum representing the enrichment made at their expense, the fact that the defendant was enriched at the expense of the plaintiff can suffice to get the plaintiff's claim off the ground, and then multiple such claims can be aggregated through a mechanism akin to class action. Under such a scheme, the plaintiffs can represent a larger number of similarly situated people at whose expense the defendant was enriched. To provide incentive to sue, of course, that representative plaintiffs can be entitled to a share of any monetary award. We know the idea from class action. As in a typical class action scenario, this award is meant to encourage a group representative to bring the claim to the court, acting as a private attorney general, and promote the overall social interest. But as I said before, there are also cases of wrongful enrichment. And I think what we do here is very different than what was usually written about these wrongful enrichment cases as well, in the sense of at the expense. Because what we offer here in this project is the idea of at the expense relying on the notion of what we term imputed plaintiffs. So to explain what it means, I want to mention a paradigmatic example based on an entirely different context. And I refer to the classic case of Briggs versus Palmer here. It incorporates really different contexts of private law, but also criminal law, as you're probably familiar with. So just to very briefly describe this case, In this case, the defendant, Elmo Palmer, was to receive a bulk of his grandfather's estate. He feared that his grandfather might change the will, and therefore he decided to poison him preemptively. After he was caught and prosecuted, Elmer was facing prison time, but the state law still permitted Elmer to inherit his grandfather's estate. Following a civil lawsuit filed by Elmer's two aunts, the New York Court of Appeal found this outcome unjust and decided that Elmer's share of the estate constitutes unjust enrichment and must be given to his two aunts. Of course, this outcome was deemed necessary to prevent Elmer from benefiting from his crime. But the reason that I'm mentioning this case to you is different. In Riggs, both defendants' enrichment and the injustice are quite easy to demonstrate, right? The benefit came to Elmer Palmer, through an horrific crime, right? But the doctrinal requirement that the enrichment would be at the expense of the plaintiff in this case merits further attention. There was no proof in this case that but for Elmer's crime, his aunts would actually inherit the estate. It was not proven that the will would have changed and in what way it will change. Nonetheless, the court considered the defendant's enrichment to be at the expense of the plaintiff, but not because the benefit correlated with some unidentifiable, I always pose with this word, loss to the plaintiff, but rather because the plaintiff in Riggs versus Palmer served an imputed beneficiary who are allowed to bring forth a claim in unjust enrichment. The court allowed the aunts monetary recovery in order to achieve a public goal of stripping the defendant from the profits obtained through an obvious crime. As imputed plaintiffs, they were allowed to access the court not because they were directly harmed, but because they are the closest private actors to the wrong that was committed. As such plaintiffs, they were allowed to recover from the wrongdoer and are entrusted with the task of pursuing sanction against the wrongdoer through civil liability and unjust enrichment. And this idea of imputed or entrusted plaintiffs can be of assistance. This is what we argue in the paper, in the context of climate litigation. So climate enrichment claims can also be brought by imputed plaintiffs who are entrusted with the right to pursue wrongdoers. This is the argument. So, on the face of it, young plaintiffs whose right in the public good of climate stability have been violated can be bring a lawsuit based on unjust enrichment, wrongful enrichment, even if some of this enrichment came at the expense of those absent at the time of litigation, such as future generations. This is possible through the same legal mechanism that allow plaintiffs such as those in Riggs versus Palmer to bring a lawsuit for benefits paid through a wrongdoing. The goal of these mechanisms is to assure that wrongful conduct does not pay by allowing a private actor closely associated with the wrong to bring the lawsuit. Now, we can think about imputed planting such NGOs, perhaps. Now, again, maybe this will require a more expansive interpretation of the notion of imputed plaintiffs, but at least it's conceptually possible. We can also think about recent scholarly calls for recognizing the right of nature and grant natural resources a separate legal entity. Like future generations, nature does not have a voice of its own. Right? Though the application of the unjust enrichment doctrine can enhance these legal innovations, to representative plaintiffs that will be able to bring forward a suit based on a claim of unjust enrichment on behalf of the environment, perhaps. Again, to of course require some development, but it looks conceptually feasible. And of course, I will not extend about this because I think this is the obvious. State actors operating as public plaintiff might also always be able to initiate climate enrichment claims, and they have, right? We know the tobacco litigation. It has been done very moderately, but we see that there are possibilities. There have been attempts before, and some of them, not many of them, though, were even successful. So I will conclude very, very briefly, really, and I don't want to repeat everything that I said. But throughout the development of the law of unjust enrichment, the general principle has been used as a flexible category. This is really how the law itself developed from this need, right? It's not equity, but we all know how mistaken payment was nothing before it became something, and it was really recently, right? It's a modern, it's still in progress. It's a law in progress. This is why it is really controversial, I think, legal field, because it's in progress. The equilibrium is still, it hasn't found its right place, but this is how it has been used as a flexible category, aiming to provide remedial solution where more established legal categories were struggling to do so. Now, again, the suggestion is not to toss tort law away, but rather more modest. And I have to repeat this because it's very important. The idea is to consider this law as an actual, likely very effective, more effective than tort law probably, means to be used in climate litigation because of its flexibility, because of its doctrinal compatibility to the unique features of climate change effects. And I think I will finish with this.
Great, thank you.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a new single by rockers The Winter in Canada called Wolves. This high-octane alt-rock track with punk edges and soaring vocals balances raw fury with undeniable hooks. Built on distorted guitars, driving bass, and thunderous drums, Wolves captures the chaos and clarity of confronting the people in power and realizing they'll let you down. Fans of Foo Fighters, Soundgarden, and Queens of the Stone Age will feel right at home with The Winter in Canada, known for their raucous live sets and blazing musicianship. Their new single, Wolves, is a statement of intent, loud, passionate, and impossible to ignore. Stay tuned for their new album to be released in July. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Wolves by The Winter in Canada on your favorite platforms and enjoy it with us here now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Yeah, let's go.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a selection from New Clarion's second EP, Phonetic. While covering a vast sonic and textural landscape, the EP explores uncomfortable feelings of tension and loss with the aim to make peace and move forward. In particular, the single Bracken moves through folktronica with brooding heaviness, while Song for Beth is more pensively uplifting indie folk. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit Kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Phonetic by New Clarion on your favorite platforms and enjoy the single Bracken with us now here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a new single called Rush Hour, produced and performed by two graduating Queen's Music students, including CFRC alum Richard Hu, a.k.a. Forged Rains, and David Yee, a.k.a. Sheep in Wolf's Clothing. The new single combines the strengths of both artists in an upbeat acid jazz track in 7+6-4 time. They welcome you to experience the culmination of their academic journeys in this electrifying collaboration. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Rush Hour by Forged Rains and Sheep in Wolf's Clothing on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a new single by local EDM artist Yuta Monique. The new track called Is This Mind Control showcases Yuta Monique's signature blend of high-energy beats and infectious melodies. The song also captures the spirit of the genre, inviting listeners to move, connect, and get lost in the rhythm. Drawing inspiration from the values of EDM culture, including peace, love, unity, and respect, Yuta Monique's song celebrates the way music brings people of all ages, backgrounds, and identities together in a shared experience of joy and unity. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Is This Mind Control by Yuta Monique on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Tattooed that again from my back, but forget it.